Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Thanks for being here. My name is Eugénie Dugois. I am an assistant professor in environmental economics here at LSE in the Department of Geography and Environment. Today, I have the pleasure to chair Professor Scott Barrett's public lecture on global ocean governance. Scott Barrett is a Lenfest Earth Institute professor of natural resource economics at Columbia University in New York City. He's also a centennial visiting professor here at the London School of Economics, which is also where Scott initially began his career. Indeed, Scott studied and received his PhD in economics here at LSE. We will not disclose the year. After that, he taught at the London Business School, then Johns Hopkins University for a while before joining Columbia in 2009. Throughout his career, Scott has literally created an entirely new scholarship studying environmental cooperation and more generally, cooperation around global public goods. In 2003, he published a seminal book entitled Environment and Statecraft, The Strategy of Environmental Treaty Making, followed by another book in 2007, Why Cooperate? The Incentive to Supply Global Public Goods. And both of these books, as you will know, as many of the students in this room will know, feature prominently on our reading list, both at the undergraduate and graduate levels. Scott's research agenda has taken him all over the world, both as an academic and in a number of roles in policy arenas, including as the lead author of the IPCC or as a member of the World Health Organization's, for example, in the Strategic Advisory Group on Malaria Eradication. So it is a great pleasure to have him here today and to have him here share his thoughts on global ocean governance. The ocean covers most of the Earth's surface, in fact, about 70%. It is governed by a combination of property rights established in customary law and cooperative agreements established under treaty law. So today, Professor Barrett will draw from several disciplines, including history, international law, and game theory, to explain how these institutions are doing, what they have done and what they have not been able to achieve, and why. So please join me in welcoming Professor Barrett.
Well, thank you very much. I guess it's a mark that you've reached a certain age when your chair doesn't want to announce what year it was you got your PhD. It was 1989. Actually, I started teaching at London Business School in 1988. And I told them I'd finish within a year, and I did. Anyway, I'm really delighted that you're here, and it's always great for me to be at LSE and to see how well LSE has done. It's changed so much since I was here. It's amazing. Okay, so I want to talk about the oceans, but also about something broader. So I have, as Eugenie was explaining, this agenda, which I started here unintentionally. I just became fascinated by, there was this treaty negotiated called the Montreal Protocol, which Eugenie has worked on as well, on the ozone layer. And at the time, I thought this was different. And I remember speaking to some of my professors here, by the way, and I asked them what they thought, and they thought, no, it's not going to become anything. It's not going to make much of a difference. And then I started working on this, and I remember one of the professors told me, no one's going to be interested in this. But anyway, just, you know, you have to know yourself what you should be doing. But the agenda is really about understanding international cooperation, particularly as regards humans in relation to the natural environment. And there are different institutions that we devise and use to change our behavior in ways that allow us to manage, I'll use that word, the environment in ways that are actually of benefit to us. So we're basically, if we're unrestrained, our behavior can be pretty self-harming. So we want to devise institutions that change how we behave for our own good. And that's what the law can help us to do. And I'm going to be focusing on a kind of international law which has been analytically studied very, very little. And the approach that I'm going to be proposing is quite different from what we've seen before. I think the insights are quite different. So I'm both interested in the oceans and ocean governance, and also with international law. Okay. Now, so this, I want to start off being very kind of broad. This is how I think of my agenda. So this image here is the iconic image of the Earth from space. It was taken from Apollo 8 on the other side of the moon on Christmas Eve 1968. So it's an image that probably everyone has seen. And it was kind of shocking. It was shocking to the astronauts aboard Apollo 8 when they saw it, just to see the Earth from that perspective. And it was shocking to those of us still on Earth, and yeah, I was around then, just to see that planet out there so alone and so vulnerable. It's just it's really transformative in how we actually think about the Earth. And I was listening to an interview on the radio, the interview with Bill Anders, who took the photo, and he said, I made this transcription myself after listening to it, as you looked at this beautiful orb, you could see no boundaries. He means lines of demarcation for nation states. No political divisions. And also you could tell that it was quite small. I mean, physically insignificant, though that's the planet on which we evolved. And I always thought it was too bad that we couldn't get the United Nations up there to see the same view, and maybe we'd stop lobbing bombs and rockets at each other and take better care of it. So that's a perspective, and it's not one we normally, you know, it's not part of our normal vision, as it were, as we do our business on the planet. The image that is more in keeping with how we think of the world is more like this, and maybe it's a geopolitical image. This particular one, it's an older globe, and it's actually showing us Africa, of course, and the outline of the continent is accurate geophysically, we know that. But you know, we colored in with these different nation states. Those nation states are purely exist in our minds. They're not real in any sense. You can't see it from Apollo 8, okay? And if you look at that particular one, you'll notice a number of straight lines. It just shows you how unreal the concept of a nation state is in terms of certainly any geophysical, topographical features. But even when it comes to Africa, even in terms of long tradition and cultural heritage, this was mainly constructed by Europeans in the late 19th century. Okay. Anyway, as we look at this, I think the quotes that are relevant are from Benedict Anderson's book, Imagined Communities. And he says the nation is an imagined political community, and imagined is both inherently limited and sovereign. Imagine because the members of even the smallest nation will never know most of their fellow members, meet them, or even hear of them, yet in the minds of each lives the image of their communion. And limited because each state has a border, and on the other side of the border lie other states, other people, us versus them. Sovereign because of the idea that a people can govern themselves. And that's basically the construct that we have. It's particularly about the nation state, but it's a construct we have about the world, and it's in opposition with the image I showed before. All right, so let's look at the oceans now. As Ujani said, there are two basic kinds of institution we use for managing the oceans, property rights and cooperative agreements. So in this image here, you see in blue, the exclusive economic zones. That's a property right arrangement that I'm going to focus on. It didn't exist when I was born. Old, that's already been well established. And it emerged actually quite spontaneously in the 1970s. I remember that actually quite distinctly. You also see these FAO regions. We don't need to worry about that. But the main thing is these exclusive economic zones, and they make up about 40% of the Earth's surface. So that's a property right that did not exist when I was born. And later in the 1970s, it existed. So that has got to be, if not the biggest, certainly one of the biggest transformations in property rights in all of world history. And yet, economists have never really studied this to the point of being able to explain how it happened and why it happened. And that's what I want to do, okay? And what the implications are for what, through this institution, customary law, what we're able to achieve. And you'll notice that the contours are just follow the continents, right? 200 miles around each one. And here you have a lot of islands. We're going to be coming back to this region later. The other approach we have is the cooperative arrangements. So these are in the fisheries area. They're called Regional Fisheries Management Organizations, RFMOs. Just like the exclusive economic zones are called EEZs. I don't like acronyms, but I might use them. Here I've only shown five RFMOs. These are all the tuna RFMOs. And you see they cover almost the entire oceans of the planet. A little bit of overlap, and also you see some straight lines. So that's always an indication of arbitrariness. This is all a human construction, all of this. And these are the two devices we use. A lot of people have dismissed the cooperative arrangements as not being very effective, but what I'm going to come to towards the end is that we need them to be more effective. So the approach that I'm going to be focusing on with property rights is of limited effectiveness. I don't think the solution to a lot of our problems as regards the oceans lie in changing those. And I'm also going to speak just a little bit about allied issues at the very end. Okay. Now, what's the difference? Well, the RFMOs are established by treaties. So you have a treaty, it creates an organization. Just like there's a treaty that created the European Union, as an organization, there's a treaty that created the United Nations. There's a treaty behind every RFMO. It's almost like a kind of a constitution. Now, the difference between these instruments is that participation in a treaty is voluntary. So a country can decide to join the treaty or not to join. If it's already in, it can pull out. If it's out, it can come in. All right. That is probably the clearest expression of sovereignty we have in the international system. Okay, it's very important. It really shapes what that treaty instrument is able to achieve as compared with, well, the other instrument we're going to look at. And when you get frustrated with the world and it's not doing what you want it to do, that's one of the reasons. But you can't just shed that. That's unfortunate. We can't just shed it. Okay, with custom, it applies universally. When you think about it, if you're going to have an international law, there has to be some kind of basis of law that is universal, that all countries recognize and abide by. Because otherwise, how would you conduct human affairs at that scale? So that's the purpose of custom. Treaties are negotiated formally. You know, people meet in capital cities, you know, like Abu Dhabi or, you know, Montreal or wherever. And they have meetings, they talk, they draw up a treaty. It's like a contract. They fuss over every word. They have a ceremony at the end. They have a photo opportunity, press conference. There's the announcement. Countries sign. Then they take the treaty home to be ratified by Parliament, which is not always a sure thing. Usually is in this country, but not always. The Maastricht Treaty, for example, was a very close call. Okay, and the United States? Okay, do I have to even finish that sentence? No, okay. Well, custom is very different. Custom arises informally and spontaneously. It's like from the bottom up. It's almost like people behaving according to a kind of a norm. You know, a norm, like when do you come to the lecture that begins at 6:30, or the norm of where do you sit in the room, things like that. And we abide by norms all the time. We don't even think about it most of the time. But with custom, it's a little different. It's not just that there's a norm of behavior. there's behind it also the understanding that there's a legal obligation to behave that way, okay? But it's informal. So it's not as if people sit around a room and come up with it. They try that occasionally, but that's not really how it works. So it's a very different kind of institution. Okay, so custom. What are the requirements of custom? There are two requirements. One is the countries have to behave in a way that is consistent with the custom. And the second is that they do that because they believe that doing that is required by law. Now that second part is weird. I mean, it's basically a psychological thing. It's in your head. I'm going to behave this way because I believe I ought to, because it's required by law. So it's very unusual. It's not like a treaty where you could read, you could look over the language, you shall do this, et cetera, et cetera. And then you know pretty much what you're supposed to do. You may argue about this or the other thing, but you know what you're supposed to do. It's clear. Custom's not really quite like that. It's quite different. But it's quite important, or at least we're going to come back to that. At least superficially it's important. For example, treaties. I said that countries are free to join them or not as they please. Well, where does that come from? That comes through custom. Again, if you're going to have a law of treaties that applies generally, it has to be that the basic rules are accepted by all the countries in the world. And another one, treaties are to be kept, which basically is like you're going to negotiate in good faith. Now, some people read into that that you get guaranteed compliance. Now, you have this expectation of compliance, but that particular aspect of custom, I think, is weak, because if you don't want to adhere to a treaty, you don't join. If you're in the treaty and you don't want to adhere to it, you leave, which countries do this. So I don't think that particular one is as powerful as sometimes people think. And this is relevant because within international law, different scholars debate whether custom really exists, and even if it does, is it just an ephemeral thing, or is it something that really changes behavior? This is something I'm going to come back to later. Okay, so the main focus is going to be on the exclusive economic zone. And in this chart, I'm showing you claims that are made by countries. So these are claims. They're not real. They're just statements. We claim an exclusive, well, in those days, the terminology for exclusive economic zone didn't emerge until the early 70s. So in the early days, this was like a fisheries conservation zone or something like that. And it may have been just an extension of the territorial sea, which at the time was 3 miles. So the background to this, the alternative to what you're seeing here is 3 miles. So in the 50s, other property rights arrangements were being declared. It doesn't mean that they were not laws. These are just claims. This is like I'm going to say something. Like I'm claiming something. It is not law unless other countries recognize the claim. Okay. So they're claiming, and you're starting to see, okay, the 12 miles, some other ones, and then 200 miles. It starts to look like the 3 mile limit, which is again is the default. It's the background, might be overtaken by 12 miles when you get to around 1970 or so. But then all of a sudden there's this burst and this big push towards 200 miles, right around here. Okay. Now, you might look at that and say, well, yeah, but there's still quite a few people, or countries rather, who are declaring 12 miles and quite a few that are declaring a different limit. But actually, all of this is pretty consistent. So the 12-mile limit, what it really means is those countries are not declaring any EZ at all. Okay, why would they do that? Well, one reason they would not declare any EZ, the Mediterranean, now it's basically all covered in exclusive economic zones. But that's fairly recent. So initially, the border states of the Mediterranean did not want to declare an EEZ. Why? Because if they did, they knew that was an invitation. It would spark responses by the other states, and you start off having access to the entire Mediterranean, and then if you start claiming different properties, the others will do it, and now you're limited to a smaller space. Okay, so they held back, they refrained from that. But in other oceans, they didn't. And what's happening in the other is that in a lot of cases, the distance between your shore and your nearest transoceanic neighbor is less than 400 miles. So you can't declare 200 miles, you have to declare something smaller than that. So what's actually happening here is the entire world is agreeing on a 200-mile exclusive economic zone. You don't have to take it, but that's the option that's available to you. So that explains what you're seeing there. And again, that happened all in the 1970s. Now, I had I had to adjust my slides because when I made them, I used the format I normally use. And LSE, now because it's such a fancy place, it wants a widescreen kind of. So I tried to redo it, and what I did, I messed up it a couple times. So this here should, this blue band should slide over a little bit. It's probably, by the way, this is just a judgment on my part. It's probably somewhere between 76 and 79. Somewhere in there, the exclusive economic zone became established. And one thing about custom is you can't pick a date by which it was established. It's not like a treaty. A treaty is adopted, it'll give you the date right there on the treaty. Well, with custom, you don't really know. Anyway, it's being established somewhere in here. The Law of the Sea was actually adopted in 1982, so again, forgive the slide. But the impression you get is right, which is that custom established the EEZ before the Law of the Sea was adopted, and it didn't enter into force until 1994, much later. This picture ends in 1985, okay. So the key thing is to understand is that the exclusive economic zone was a part of customary law before it became obligatory in the Law of the Sea. Another way to understand how important this is that the United States is not a party to the Law of the Sea, but the United States recognizes the 200-mile exclusive economic zone as existing in customary law and abides by it. I'll come back to the U.S. later. Okay, so what the presentation I'm giving is based on some research I've done. I have to say, okay, confession. I've spent more time working on this paper than any paper in my entire life. So I'm probably like, you know, people are going to wonder, why? Like, it's so easy. It's not that, okay. It takes a long time to make something look easy. At least it does for me. Okay, but what I'm going to do, I want to take you through this because there's a logic here that I want you to understand. So what I'm always interested in is not to convince anyone of anything. I have no interest in that. I want to be helpful to how you and we all see things, okay? So it's all about seeing things. What's different about this paper from what existed previously in the literature is the fisheries are going to be not only spatially situated, but spatially situated in relation to where the states are. It's very important for this property right. And that means we're also going to introduce a variable that has never been used in the fisheries literature before, which is distance. You'd think it would have been kind of a natural thing. It's not been done. Almost the entire literature has been based on fishing taking place in zero space, literally. You know, when you're taught things and you're shown the equations and all that, this is the kind of thing people don't normally point out. It's like an assumption that all of this is taking place on the point of a pin. And you know, maybe there are reasonable reasons for doing that, but what I want to do is change that, because you can't really understand geography if it's all collapsed in that way. I'm also going to look at different kinds of fishery. This is new, too. People haven't done this before, so I know just making up three. You could make up more. A nearshore fishery, an offshore fishery, and a highly migratory fishery. And then I'm going to solve for the property rights arrangement. I'm going to do that by modeling customary law in a way that is consistent with my reading of international law. And I want to compare that to the alternative, which is how states would choose if they could choose in their own self-interest independently of how others choose. That's like the default, countries just acting independently, sovereignty, okay. And we want to compare those two, because then we can find out, well, is custom doing anything for us? And we can also look at the world and ask, well, when you see a custom and you look at the behavior, is it the custom that's driving the behavior, or are we simply calling the behavior that would have existed anyway a custom? And there's a big controversy in law about that, that comparison. All right, so this is how I'm going to explain the model. The world is complicated. I'm not handling the world right now. This is London. This is one of the early maps of the London Underground. And if you follow, I'm not sure what line this is, but this one or this one or this one over here, what you see is that it's curved. It's accurately drawn in relation to the major roads, in relation to major monuments and so on, parks. And it's accurate, and it's confusing. There's so much information there. Now, when you develop theory, what you're trying to do is simplify the world. So a lot of people don't quite get this. They're saying, why are you doing this? Because you're not able to predict things. So you, actually, what economists are trying to do is simplify. So this is an early drawing of the London Underground map by Harry Beck, who I understood did this on his own initiative. He just wanted, is there kind of an easy way in which we could map the underground? So that's his draft. That's what almost all my work always looks like, except there's a lot more scratching out and, and erasing. Okay. And then finally, you come up with the final map. And if you look at this map, the distance between every station is the same. It's uniform. Now, we know the actual distance is not identical, but spatially, aesthetically, in terms of conveying what the map wants to convey, it's much more helpful. So it's a misrepresentation of reality, but it's helpful. And I think that's also true of the theory I'm going to be presenting in a minute. And all the lines are vertical, horizontal, or 45 degrees. So it's an abstraction. But when you want to know how to get from point A to point B, this is the map to have. Okay. Whereas the map we started with, you know, it's complicated. Okay. So this is what theory is trying to do. Okay. So with this as background, what does my ocean look like? I spent a lot of time working on this paper. I spent a lot of time thinking about this. How do you actually portray the ocean in an abstract way? I tried different ways. This is what I came down with. All right, so what I've done, so remember that the basic model of a fishery, all the fishing takes place on a point. A point has zero spatial dimension. What I want to do is make the smallest change I can. As an approach to modeling, if everyone knows a certain model and you want to come up with something new, the best thing to do is come up with something that's new only in the smallest number of ways. You don't want to like change like a lot of things because then no one knows what's going on. So what I want to do is take the spatial model of zero, the one that is normally used, and add one more dimension. So the dot becomes a line. But once you have a line, you can have multiple lines, and then they can cross and so on. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to array the lines in a two-dimensional frame. Okay? And I want symmetry because it's easy to work on. So I'm going to array the countries around the circle equidistantly from each other. And the size of the ocean is the length of the line, which is the sum of, let's say, these four lines from each country. This would be the home port for country four and so on, to the center of the ocean. Okay? So if you add up all those, well, either the two lines or the four, depending on how you read the diagram, that's the ocean. That's the length of the ocean. That's the size of the ocean in one dimension. Now, if you double the number of countries, you have to have twice as many countries around the perimeter of the circle. And the lines connecting the countries, the sum of the lengths of all these lines, have to equal the same as in the original picture. So this is the ocean with eight countries, and that's the ocean with four. It's a little weird, but the more you think about it, I think you can see what's going on. Okay. Now, one thing I hope to come back to later is in this period of history I want to look at, there's actually a big increase in the number of countries over time. And what's happening now is that, in a sense, it's almost as if the ocean is smaller. Of course, the ocean literally is not smaller, but because there are more countries exploiting the ocean, it's almost like that. Okay, so that's the ocean, but now we have to bring in the fisheries. So again, I'm just making this up. when I model something, I want it to be wrong in the most obvious way. So there's not like a big discussion about it. You can see what it is. You can see what's, it's simple. And if you want to change it, you can change it. It's easy to change. All right, so with a highly migratory fishery, this thick line is showing where the fish are. And I'm assuming, I don't have to do this, but I'm assuming they're uniformly distributed on that thick line. Okay, so the line underneath is the ocean. The highly migratory fish are swimming everywhere in the ocean. Okay, the offshore, they're only swimming in the central part, so they're not touching the home ports of the different countries. And the near shore, the fish are only extending from the home ports and they're not going into the center of the oceans. Okay, so those are three different versions. They're about as simple as you can get. You can always make them more complicated. I would invite you to do that. Okay, now this is what the world looks like. And even though I do work this very abstract, I'm really interested in the world, okay, just to be clear about it. And okay, so this is a way to connect it. The top picture, we're looking at the, these were 143 bluefin tuna. They were tagged and then followed. And you can see their movements. The migrations are phenomenal. It's an incredible creature. And so you're seeing them mainly between, well, the United States, Mexico, and Japan in that particular image. So that's an example of what a highly migratory fishery might look like. There's only one fishery that from today's exclusive economic zone is exclusively fished in the high seas, and those are the Patagonia toothfish, which I think, at least in American restaurants, are called Chilean sea bass. It kind of sounds better. Toothfish, it doesn't sound so great, I guess. I don't know. The marketing people had to go at that one. Anyway, so these are the populations of the toothfish. And this is Antarctica. And the claims over Antarctica are very disputed. They're not settled. And you can't really have claims to an exclusive economic zone. So this is all high seas area here. And then finally, this is for cod, and you can see the outlines of North America, Greenland, and Iceland, and Europe. And the gray areas are where cod is distributed. The dark areas are where there's spawning grounds. Okay, so that's what a nearshore fishery looks like. You don't have cod out in the middle of the ocean. Okay. All right, now I'm going to introduce an institution, but I'm going to do it exogenously. I'm just going to say, let's throw in an exclusive economic zone. How would this change things? So let's start with a highly migratory fishery. Suppose you're country one, and the EEZ is of this length here, and it's uniform for everyone. Then if you're country one, when you go to fish, you can fish the distance from the home port into the center of the ocean, and you can go out in these arms, but only as far as the EEZ allows. Okay. In the offshore fishery, you can do the same, but you're confined to a really small space here. And in the nearshore fishery, you can only go out, well, if you're country one, you can only go out to the extent of the fishery. Okay, so it's fairly straightforward. That's all exogenous, but what I want to look at is how would countries choose? And remember, when countries choose, they're choosing under two different regimes. One is when they can choose independently, just acting out of sovereignty without being restrained by an institution like customary law, and the other is what customary law might ask of them, require of them. Oh, okay, so one more picture. If you draw the current EEZ, this is Iceland. These are the demersal fish. These are the ground fish, cod and halibut. And you see they're almost all contained within the EEZ. This is shrimp and Norway lobster, and they are contained within the EEZ. And these are the pelagics, like herring and mackerel, and they definitely will extend outside the EEZ. So one thing I want to know is how with the way these fisheries overlap with the jurisdiction, how did that shape how the jurisdictions were chosen? Okay, all right, this is the only picture I have with any math, but I did want to be clear, because it's so easy to sound confident. I don't want to convince you of anything, I want to show you something, okay? I want you to decide yourself what you think of it. So this is a basic model we use in fisheries economics. The harvest that a country I in this case, a harvest that it's able to extract, depends on the effort it expends. So effort, think about boats, crews, nets, engine size, all those kinds of things. And the stock of fish available to it. What's different when you have a spatial model is that the stock depends on the distance that the country chooses over the entire length of the ocean, in the case of a highly migratory species. So the highly migratory, again, extend throughout the ocean. And your distance, how far you travel in the ocean, will determine how much of that stock you have access to. So that's what you're seeing in that expression. And a standard expression in the literature would be this alpha, which is sometimes called the catchability coefficient, which I think is kind of cute, and then effort, and then the stock. You just normally don't have a subscript to the stock. Okay, so this is what's different. And because you have a subscript to the stock, that is due to the distance you're choosing. So the distance variable is the thing that's really new. And then the other thing to pay attention to is the cost. So the cost to country I, now normally it would just depend, it would be proportional to the effort. That's a standard in the literature. And I have to introduce distance, which I'm doing this way. So the costs are going to increase for given distance as you add effort. They're also going to increase for given effort as you travel farther, okay? So it's all included in here. But one thing you notice when you look at this is that if you increase effort by one unit, costs increase by this amount. If you increase a distance by one unit, costs increase by this amount. Okay. And so what that basically shows is because there's a fixed cost to effort, what this shows is it's always cheaper to extend the distance than to expand effort. All right, that's coming from that assumption. Up here, however, the harvest increases equally as you increase the distance or the effort. So to sum that up, the way I've modeled this, which I think is reasonable, but it's not the only way you probably want to do it, but the reasonable way to do it, I think, in the simplest way, it shows that increasing distance or increasing effort are equally good at increasing harvest. But increasing distance is cheaper than increasing effort. So your first preference is always to increase distance. And once you've gone the maximum distance, basically, you then want to choose your effort. And that's how that model gets solved. OK. Now, the default with property, we have to solve this, we have to choose the institutional arrangement. The default with property rights is that countries choose independently. And that's the Nash equilibrium we're looking at. This is probably the only place I could give a public lecture using that terminology, but I know the LSE, you know, it's a special place, so I know I can do this. And the alternative is customary law. So now the question is, okay, well, how do you model customary law? There's only a couple papers that have vaguely tried to do it, and I think they're wrong. Well, I leave it to other people. I mean, but I think they're wrong. That's my opinion. Now, one of the a book that I find really explains international law well is by someone named Shaw. I think it's Malcolm Shaw. I think he's at Cambridge. I've read a lot of books in international law, but I like his book a lot. Anyway, he has this one quote, which I think is just the nicest way of understanding how custom works. Here he's speaking of, you start with a 3-mile territorial sea, and then you're going to increase to 12 miles, which is what happened at the same time as the EEZs were established, all this in the 1970s. If a state proclaims a 12-mile limit, so remember, the default is 3, you're starting at 3. If a state proclaims a 12-mile limit to its territorial sea in the belief that although the 3-mile limit has been accepted law, the circumstances are so altering at this point in time that a 12-mile limit might now be treated as becoming law. That choice, that country, is vindicated if other states follow suit and a new rule of customary law is established. That would be 12 miles. If other states reject the proposition, then the projected rule withers away and the original rule stands, reinforced by state practice and common acceptance. Okay. So what happens with custom is when you choose to go from 3 to 12, if no one joins you, it stays at 3. And your claim is just words that signify nothing. If you choose 12 and others start choosing 12, 12 can become the new limit, and it's established in customary law. And the key thing to understand is that is not a Nash equilibrium. Then in the Nash equilibrium, when you choose, you're assuming and you're believing that other countries are not going to respond to your choice. Here, you know that your choice can only apply if other countries adopt the same choice. It's totally different. And it's really important to understand this because very well-known lawyers have not understood this basic point. Okay, so this is how I'm going to model it. And this is the last like formal picture. Countries are going to choose a claim over an EEZ of some length. So every country can always announce a claim. And it's been, if you look at the history, countries are doing it all the time. In stage two, if this is this claim is made in the context of customary law, an EEZ of length Z, so we're going to determine what that is, identical for every country, is established in customary law and is thus binding upon all states if and only if states claim this value generally. Otherwise, the pre-existing arrangement applies. And finally, in stage three, countries choose effort and distance independently. Now, under international law, countries can do this. The RFMOs try to change this, but you don't have to belong to an RFMO, and their ability to change this is limited. So this is sovereignty here. At the very top is sovereignty, what you're claiming. But in between, you've got this institution, which is customary law. So in a Nash equilibrium, countries are making claims in stage one. This doesn't exist. And then having done that, they choose their effort and distance. That's the Nash equilibrium. But if you have customary law, you have to include this intermediate stage. That's the difference. Okay, so I'm going to model it both ways. And this is what I get. And for a highly migratory fishery, if you had a Nash equilibrium, there'd be no high seas at all. So what would happen is, remember, a Nash equilibrium means if I extend my property right a little bit, I'm assuming that no one's going to respond to that. Well, if I extend it a little bit, I get exclusive access to the fish there. So of course I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to do it some more. And then I'm going to do it, and everyone else is going to do it some more. So what's going to happen is the entire ocean is going to be nationalized. That's the prediction of the Nash equilibrium. With customary law, you wouldn't do this. Why? If I extend my EEZ a little bit, yeah, I gain, but the problem is I'm giving permission to everyone else to extend their EEZ, and now I don't have access to theirs. And their area is much bigger than just mine, so I don't want to do that. I'm held back. I'm restrained. Well, this is what good institutions do. They hold us back. We have this temptation to do something, and the institutions make us hold back. Offshore, you get the same thing. Now, nearshore is different. Because nearshore, if you extend your EEZ by enough, you can exclude all other states from fishing in the fishery, and then you have your sole owner, and you can maximize the efficiency of the fishery. So the nearshore fishery is different, and you would expect an EEZ. For the others, you wouldn't. And this one, what's happening is custom is the same as the Nash equilibrium. So there are some lawyers, well, these lawyers, oh, you can't see their, again, the. When I had to redo the slides, things got, the computers, they don't align. Anyway, I'm sorry. This is an article by Jack Goldsmith, who's a very well-known lawyer at Harvard. He was in the George W. Bush administration. And the other author is Eric Posner, who's the son of Richard Posner, who's a very famous lawyer at University of Chicago. And so they're very well known, and they basically argued that custom is indistinguishable from the Nash equilibrium. Well, it's true here. And in their paper, by the way, the only example they look at is the 3-mile territorial sea. Well, that's Nazi, because why not look at the extension of 3 to 12 miles? They don't do that. Why not look at the EEZ? It's the obvious case to look at. They don't look at it. Okay. Always got to be careful when you look, when you read papers, not what's there, but what's not there. It's like the most important thing. It's not shouting at you, but that's what you always have to look for. And here you see there's a huge difference. So if Nash behavior was governing the oceans, we would have nationalized the entire oceans, and we haven't. So that tells me custom is actually working. Now, this idea of countries nationalizing the oceans, you think, well, that's absurd. It's not absurd. They tried to do this before. Okay. This goes back to, you know, as countries were expanding, nation states were being created, and you had technology changing, and the two main maritime powers in the 15th, early 16th century, Spain and Portugal, different city-states in Spain and Portugal, they divided up the world's oceans pretty much, okay? So this was claimed for Spain, this for Portugal, and they agreed on that. Now later on, other countries, as they're rising as powers, including Britain, started to protest this and wanted to change this. But when they did this, there was no real international law. So it's actually completely consistent with the theory. Now, by the way, just so you know, I don't write a theory down so that it gives me what we know happened. I never do that, because that's just a waste of everyone's time and effort. You let the theory tell you what it is, good or bad, helpful or unhelpful, and then you check out what is the world like. Okay. So, but what I'm showing you is that this property rights arrangement, that's the first impulse that states had. That's Mare Clausium, which is a closed sea, and the open sea principle, which pretty much applies today, was first proposed by Grotius in the early 17th century, and that's the rule that we're applying now. But that is the time when international law was really developing. Okay. So what we're seeing here is pretty consistent with history. Now, how do you know that custom is doing anything for you? All right, I'm going to give you one example, one illustration, and really one should be enough, because if you find one where it's not self-interest that's guiding behavior, then, I don't know how else you would explain this. This is the exclusive economic zone. This is North America, this is the US, this is Canada, and this here is the exclusive economic zone. And this other line here is the it's like the continental shelf, basically. And there's an area that sticks out here called the tail, and another area here, the nose, and this little area over here, this little seamount, Flemish Cap. These are all prime fishing grounds, and they're just outside the EEZ. Now, if you had Nash, there is no way that Canada would hold back. Canada would claim those areas as quickly as it possibly could. And in fact, there was a parliamentary committee convened not that long ago, and they looked to do that, and they concluded that they couldn't. And the reason they concluded they couldn't, they said, yes, it's in our interest to do it, but we can't do it because if we tried to do it, other states wouldn't accept this. And the reason they wouldn't accept it is that they have nothing to gain by extending their EEZs that way either. So this is sustained as an equilibrium in customary law precisely for that reason. Okay. Now you might ask, why did they choose a mile limit? Why not choose something else, like a geophysical feature? And I don't have a specific answer to that. But if you looked at what's possible, one thing that's possible is you could have looked at the continental shelf. Now if they had chosen the continental shelf as the property rights arrangement, the nose and tail would have been included for Canada. So I think, okay, it makes sense. And they did choose this for minerals and so on, resources that are below the seafloor. And that can extend out to 350 miles, and so not just 200 miles, but it can extend to 350 or even further than that. Okay. So that option was available, they didn't choose it. But if you look at a map, this shows the EZs in this little faint white outline here. And then these areas in what looks like a rust color, this would be the continental shelf area. And if you look at it, it would be very asymmetric. And also, if that was the definition for a fishery, there'd be so many areas. Like this is a rich fishing ground here. Most of this is very rich fishing ground, and there's no continental shelf there, right? So it's not obvious that that would be the approach to take. So they could have taken it, they didn't. But when you look at it, it's actually not obvious that, oh, I have 10 minutes? Okay. So why choose 200 miles? Okay. Now what's cool about the theory is the theory doesn't predict 200 miles because that would be ridiculous. But what the theory does is it says it has to be big enough, and then there's a maximum it can be because there's only so far you can go. If everyone's extending the EZ the same amount, they're going to meet in the middle. So what the theory says is it's going to be somewhere in between being big enough and the maximum. But where you are in there, the theory says it does not matter. Now something, you have to choose some value there, and how would you do it? Well, this is where Thomas Schelling's theory of focal points, I think, is very apt. But I'm going to tell you a story of how this happened. So the story starts with the United States. Just at the like almost everything interesting in international relations for the modern world, so much happened at the near the end of World War II. So much happened. And one thing was that Harry Truman, this is right after Roosevelt died, issued a proclamation, and he asserted the right of the United States to establish fisheries conservation zones in those areas of the high seas contiguous to its coasts due to concern about the inadequacy of present arrangements for the protection and perpetuation of the fishery resources in these seas. In the same announcement, by the way, this is only like two paragraphs, in the same announcement, he also recognizes the right of any state to establish conservation zones off its shores in accordance with the same principles as would be required if the right would be established in customary law. Okay, so the U.S. makes this announcement. Now, what's very weird is that they make the announcement and then they never made any claims. Bizarre. Like, why would you do that? But what they did do is they basically gave an invitation to the rest of the world to start making claims, and the rest of the world did. The first country to make a move was Chile. In 1947, Chile declares 200-mile zone. Now, they have to petition the president to actually make this claim. So it's a whaling company in Chile that wants to make the claim. Now, during World War II, there was a suspension of a lot of fishing and whaling activity all over the world. And what's happening is states who are coastal states that are more used to the rich, big, distant water states coming in and capturing all the fish, they actually realized when those states were gone how much they had there in terms of resources. And having experienced that, they didn't want these people coming back in, right? They wanted to keep it for themselves. So this whaling company wanted to petition the president to declare a new fishery zone for whaling. And what they wanted was a 50-mile zone. That's all they wanted. That's all they cared about. But their lawyers told them, no, 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 you can't claim 50. You have to have a precedent. And the precedent they found was 200. That precedent was in a treaty called the Declaration of Panama, which was to establish a no-conflict zone during World War II. At this time, the United States was not a belligerent. So this is all about Europe and Germany, Italy, Japan, and so on. But this is before the United States entered the war. And the State Department decided that what they wanted was 300 miles. So they drew this map here of the Americas, around 300 miles. They left out Canada because Canada was in under foreign policy, was under Great Britain. And what Roosevelt did, he sees this map, and he takes out a pencil and a ruler, and he draws straight lines to connect these things. Okay. And then the State Department expressed that in terms of coordinates of longitude and latitude. And then this was brought for the negotiations, and all the countries in the Americas agreed to this. So they started with 300, and then they came up with something that was totally different from that. But the lawyers didn't take it from the treaty, probably because they couldn't read coordinates or something like that. I'm not sure. But there was an article in a magazine, a Chilean magazine, that drew a picture of the map. But unfortunately, the artist got the map wrong. So you can actually see that it's actually wrong. And it shows here off of Chile's coast that the gap is about 200 miles, but it wasn't, actually. So there was a mistake. So you're choosing, you think you need a precedent, when it wasn't clear you did. You choose a precedent and take the number from that when the number you're taking is wrong, and it wasn't even the one originally proposed. So like, it just shows you that the choice is completely arbitrary. Okay. One other thing that's happening here is the number of states is increasing over time. This is partly due to the decolonization period, you know, very important. A lot of states are just becoming nation states. So again, as I showed you before, in a sense, the distances between states in this model start to shrink, and there's more competition, really, for fish. Another thing is that technology is changing. This alpha we saw before, that's changing. And these two things are really going to favor a change in property rights. Okay, now why? Another thing is the scope of the property right. And the question is, what my theory says is that, well, this should apply to nearshore fisheries. But when you actually look at the history, Chile wanted to exclude foreign whalers near its coast. Now, that's for a highly migratory, they're not fish, whales, they're mammals. But, and Peru and Ecuador, what they really cared about was tuna. So they're highly migratory. So the model doesn't seem to quite match up here. But to understand this, you have to change the model or put it into a slightly different context, which is a regional sea. And in a regional sea, you have the coastal states, and then you have distant water states that can come in and fish. Okay, they're coming from afar. So if you have this EEZ here, and states claim this exclusive economic zone, then this would be the high seas area, and country one can exploit this region from its home port all the way into the center and then out to these arms here, as it were, whereas the distant water state can only fish the smaller amount. So if their economics of fishing are similar, as you increase the EEZ, the economics of fishing for the distant water state is going to become less and less attractive, whereas the home state, it becomes more attractive. Okay. And that's basically what seems to be going on here, is that if you extend the EEZ enough, you push out the distant water states, and you again get a result where you don't get a particular number, you get an interval that would have to be satisfied by the EEZ. Now, another thing that happened is that the U.S., I told you I'd come back to the U.S., the U.S. claimed that Their understanding of the EEZ, so they accept the EEZ, but they thought it only applied to nearshore fisheries and not to highly migratory fisheries. Now, other people pointed out, well, but that might be because the United States has not a very large tuna stock in its own waters and fishes a lot in other countries' EEZs. In other words, self-interest would be driving their interpretation of customary law. So the U.S. is arguing that the highly migratory, the tuna stocks, should be treated as a coherent unit and managed by RFMOs, and only the nearshore stocks should be covered under the EEZs. Well, the other coastal states, or most of the other coastal states, disagree with this. So the distant water states pretty much were on board with the United States at first, and then later they started dropping off, and the U.S. was isolated. Okay. All right. Well, one thing, this is kind of cute. The U.S. is saying we should manage this through the RFMOs. At the time, so most U.S. tuna fishers were in the eastern tropical Pacific, okay? And at the time, they were negotiating the Inter-American Tropical Tuna Agreement. And the U.S. negotiator said they dismissed any thought that a management regime would allocate the fish harvest on some equitable or other basis for the nations involved in the fishery. In other words, they wanted first come, first serve, and it just happened that they were the first to come. So self-interest is definitely guiding this. But what happened was there was a standoff between the U.S. and other countries in the Americas, so the big rich fishing zones right here. And there was a standoff, and the U.S. government actually encouraged its tuna fishers to go in there and take the tuna. And if they were apprehended by the coastal states, the U.S. would pay for their any fines and legal costs that they had. You had this kind of standoff. It went on for a while. It was called the Tuna Wars. But then they moved to the Central and Western Pacific. Now, over here, you see there's a lot of the tuna they're catching is in the high seas area. Okay. When you move to this fishery, where there are actually more tuna, almost all of it's covered within the EEZs. Okay. So what happened was when they moved in here, these little tiny island states had more power because of their the expanse of their EEZs. Another thing that happened is that the Soviet Union, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union agreed to do agreements with these island states. And during the Cold War, the United States couldn't lose its influence in the Pacific, so the United States backed off. Now, what I'm trying to get at is that in a regional sea, the property rights arrangement is going to reflect power. And it shouldn't be surprising, but what's cute about this is that the U.S. is the most powerful, or at least as powerful as the Soviet Union. But it's not getting its way, and these little tiny island states that have almost zero power normally have a lot of power. So it's kind of, the world is diverse, and you have to look at the whole range of experiences to really understand it. It's not that the powerful are always the ones you think they are. I like that story. Okay, last thing I want to end on. So how much time? I know I've already used up all my time, probably. Yeah, Eugenie is saying yes. Just very quickly.
Thank you.
Huh?
can grant you an extension.
Yeah, okay, I'll try to be really quick. But thank you. You know, my age, I should have figured out how to give a talk on time, but I get kind of overexcited about things, and I can't, okay. Now, there have been two, I would call them radical proposals on how we can improve management of the oceans, from mainly from economists. So one was White and Costello did an analysis about banning all fishing on the high seas. Now, that's a pretty strong proposal. And that was picked up by somebody called the Global Ocean Commission, and they actually recommended this. I'll use my model to ask if countries would actually want that. Okay, I'm going to come to that. An economist in Bergen, Norway, who's actually Icelandic, I believe, Hannesson, he proposed that we should nationalize the high seas. So he wanted to basically go for that Nash solution. We already saw that the Nash solution is not as efficient as having keeping the high seas. Okay, so this is something that countries, in my model, would not choose under customary law, and actually that would be a good thing. But we haven't looked at banning fishing on the high seas. To do that, for looking at a highly migratory fishery, we're just saying if this is the extent of the EEZ, this area here can't be fished by any state. And what you see there, what's going to happen is that you still have the same number of countries fishing, so the competition, as it were, for fishing is the same. The tragedy of the commons is the same. Access is reduced, but remember, when access is reduced, that means distance is reduced, which pushes up costs. So this turns out not to address the tragedy of the commons, but it does increase costs, and for those reasons, it would not be supported. What I find interesting, I'm not saying that my model is right and the model by Costello and White is wrong, but what I find interesting is that different economists model something in pretty plausible ways, come up with exactly the opposite conclusions. Okay, some people are going to think, well, of course that's true, but it doesn't happen that often, and this case is really quite clear, and so at the very least, I think this should make us think twice. Okay, let me end there, so we should have questions, but there's more I could say, and of course, I have more slides. I'm going to jump ahead, because if I jump ahead, you get the LSE logo, and we're supposed to end with that, so let me do that now. Now you see what you're missing. It's really cool. All right, thank you very much.
Wonderful, thanks a lot. We've learned a lot about ocean governance. It's really fascinating to see the historical approach. I have quite a few questions actually, but I would like to maybe open it to the floor to first get a couple of questions. Yes, sir? So, and then second person in front afterwards.
Thank you. Professor, that was absolutely absorbing, but and I really enjoyed it if fish were the only thing that lived or existed in the oceans. But of course, you didn't talk about the seabed.
Yes.
So does your model just remain a theoretical model if every country, which they do, also looks at what happens underneath the seabed, be it oil or manganese nodules or whatever it happens to be? And therefore, that becomes perhaps the most important thing you stick to on Mars, because that's a physical limit and you take what you can get, never mind the fish.
Right, well, that's a very good point. So we have, in the law of the sea, we have the rule, as you probably know better than I do, we have the rule that you can extend out to the end of the continental shelf, and I showed you how that would be calculated. And countries are making claims, and then there's a committee, I think, that evaluates the claims and decides whether they're legitimate. According to the law of the sea. Of course, the United States is not a party to that, and this property right is, my understanding, customary law is always going to be a gray area, but my understanding is not clearly accepted in customary law. So I think this is more of a disputed area and is more a little more open to dispute. There's also the area beyond the continental shelf, the deep sea floor, which comes under the jurisdiction of the International Seabed Authority, and they are now issuing. So this was a very big issue in the 70s with the negotiation. The Law of the Sea was renegotiated in the 90s about this point. And the International Seabed Authority is actually issuing, I think I could use the term licenses for maybe not exploration. I'm not sure the language may really matter here, but charting basically. But we're basically moving toward a world where there's going to be intense competition for mining in the seas, part of that driven by the need to decarbonize and using more resources for things like making batteries. So we're seeing more competition there. To my knowledge, I think that a commercial mining operation is not up and running quite yet, but they're being planned and they're coming. So I think that area is a little bit more fluid. I may possibly get involved in that myself, and so if you ask me that question or point out that comment a year or so from now, I might be able to give you a better answer. But my impression is that that's a little more fluid than the case with fisheries right now. Even with fisheries, by the way, I didn't show you all my slides. Climate change is changing the fisheries story too, because sea level rise is shifting where the EEZs might be. And then there's going to be discussion or dispute about where they are. Are they where they used to be, or are they going to be where they're moving toward? And if you look, and also the fish themselves are moving with climate change. You take those two things, and countries like in the Central and Western Pacific that did so well in the story I told you before, they may actually lose out significantly from this. So there's going to be, basically there are a lot of tensions, a lot of conflict, in general, of course, but specifically also about the ocean. And this is intensifying in a way it hasn't done in quite a long time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we had another question, the one row in, yes.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hi, Prof. Barrett. Thank you for the insightful presentation. I was wondering, how did you monitor, the migration of fish, and also, for the EEZ, how do people actually observe, if certain, regulations have been violated, or if, the fish has exceeded the boundary, et cetera, from the data perspective?
Well, from a data perspective, I'm not a fisheries expert. there's a paper I liked a lot by someone named Gabe Englander, who did his PhD at Berkeley and is now at the World Bank. He looked at fishing in the oceans, and he looked at fishing inside and outside the EEZ, and particularly unlicensed or unauthorized fishing. And what he found was that it was a lot more intense just outside the EEZ than inside. What that tells you right away is that there had to be enforcement. And if there's enforcement, it must be that there's something that the coastal state gains from having the EEZ. So I think that's quite powerful. Unfortunately, what you can't tell from that is whether the EEZ is really helping a lot with conservation, because you don't have the with and without world, which is what you really want. You have to answer that question. But that is an example of the kind of research that's being done with data. Also, you have a thing called a vessel monitoring scheme. So we're actually monitoring vessels. There's there's a bit of chicanery that always goes on in the world, and maybe especially in fishing, where people try to turn off their transponders and so on. But our ability to monitor is much greater now than it ever used to be, and that's tightening up more and more over time. So that's going to create opportunity. You can't have any kind of cooperative agreement without monitoring. And so I think that is going to help over time with fishing. But generally speaking, technology tends to advance in the direction of capturing more fish, not conserving them.
Do we have an online question, or is it,
it's a friend?
It's
actually a question of myself.
Very good.
My question is, what if we add overfishing? So states may own their or manage, but mismanage actually, not their sea. And I'm thinking about this idea of making of a ban on fishing in the open sea, because Costello also showed that if you consider small ocean reserves that are now being established or have been established, actually they increase the total harvest, because these grounds are used then for reproduction of the fish.
Well, I'm actually glad you mentioned that, partly because that was one of the slides that I had to jettison. So there's, as some of you may know, there's been active negotiations leading to a new treaty in the high seas, Areas Beyond National Jurisdiction, another acronym, ABJ. And part of that enables countries to establish what are called marine protected areas, which is a bit of a form of area-based management you can have with fisheries. And people are really advocating for this. Now, I'm reluctant to use my model because it doesn't have a lot of richness in terms of ecosystems. Like, I don't have spawning areas. And you know, I really want to be careful about this. On the other hand, there are a couple things I could point out on this. First of all, that treaty, like every treaty, applies to the countries that sign and ratify it, provided it enters into force. Okay, so far I believe two countries have ratified, and you need 60 or something like that. The numbers would be a little off, something like that. So we're not there yet. But even if we get that and it enters into force, if a country that is a party to the treaty doesn't like a proposal to create a marine protected area, it can object. This is how a lot of fisheries agreements work too. If I object, this is where sovereignty really shows. If I object, under this treaty, under all the fisheries treaties, I can act as I please. Okay? Now, they have language about you have to justify your objection, but countries will be able to do that, just like they've justified scientific whaling and so on and so forth. We see that all the time. Also, of course, if you're a non-party to that treaty, whatever the treaty decides does not apply to you. So that is the wrong arrangement for establishing marine protected areas, you would think. Now, the nice thing about custom is it should apply universally. The bad thing about custom is, yes, you can choose something like a general rule, like a 200-mile EEZ. You can't choose an MPA, which is always going to be very specific, right? It's going to be those analysis that was done about where the spawning is, and where the sensitive ecosystems are, and all those kinds of things. Also, where the harvesting is. Now, and then if you look practically, okay, the first so-called high seas marine protected area was in the Ross Sea. It was one of my pictures that I had of jettison. In the Ross Sea off of Antarctica. And when that was established, first off, it only lasts for 35 years. Secondly, only some countries are establishing it under the Antarctica regime. Third, they are changing the harvest constraints that applied in adjacent seas. Okay, and so it's not obvious that by doing this you're bringing about a fundamental change. Now, I am not the expert on this, so I want to be careful. I mean, you'd have to look into a lot of details about this. But what I'm worried about is that some people will think a marine protected area is some kind of solution, and it's not clear to me that it would be. Also, I showed you the Central and Western Pacific Ocean. Well, the little island states there have very large EEZs. There are some pockets. There are a few very small pockets of high seas. Those states, because of the power they wield, unilaterally, well, in a cooperative agreement amongst certain the island states, declared closed fishing in the high seas areas. And they were able to do that because they denied permits to countries to fish within their EEZs, which are much more expansive, if they were found to have fished in the high seas areas. Okay, so it was a de facto closed high seas. But when that was observed, what happened was fishing increased in the areas in the adjacent EEZs. So I am skeptical that this is a simple solution to an overfishing problem. Bear in mind, if you had efficient management of a fishery, one of the options available to the countries would be that you would adopt area-based measures. I mean, it's, you know, for example, you would definitely want to treat spawning areas differently from other areas, and so on and so forth. So that seems like a natural thing to do. So if you had effective cooperation, you may or may not want to do this. It would be something you could do. But that brings us back to the need to make these fisheries agreements effective. The last thing I should say about that is most of these fisheries agreements are really about certain limited fish stocks, and they're not really ecosystem-based. So all of this needs to be reviewed, but I do worry about people believing that they've now found a solution to something, because it never works quite like that.
Just to bounce back on this, because that's also something I was thinking about, like the fact that you find such a different sort of result from the Costello paper, right? Of like this idea of closing the high seas. My very basic understanding, like the intuition that I have for that, is that, I mean, the further away you go, like in the high seas, like you're in the midst of really like a global tragedy of the common. If you were to put that off, you restrict the fishery, the tragedy of the common problem at a more national level, where
Absolutely.
Hopefully you would have more capacity to enforce whatever national fishery policy you figure that is the optimal policy for your fish, local fisheries to be sustainable. And I guess this capacity of, with the greater enforcement capacity is related to the monitoring capabilities, which I suppose the further, I don't know, I guess that's a question mark that I have, like, you know, how easy it is concretely to actually close the high seas, if that is technologically something that we would be able to enforce.
You could definitely do it, and you could definitely enforce it. So another slide that I didn't show you. it was the last slide that I skipped over. It was of the North Pacific. So this is an area that where you have salmon. And as you know, salmon spawn in inland rivers and spend most of their life at sea. And they're fished at sea. And there's an exception in the law of the sea, really fascinating, which is to treat salmon differently from all other fish. So they are anadromous fish because of the way they spawn. And under that law of the sea, the home states, states of origin they're called, states of origin. So the fish, the salmon are spawning in Canadian rivers, American, North American, U.S. rivers, Russia, Japan, maybe one or two. There are two others, maybe South Korea. And there's just some other. Anyway, and there's wide fishing in that. Well, under that treaty, what they've done is they've prevented states of origin from fishing in the high seas. It's in the Law of the Sea treaty. And then the states of origin have wanted to extend that to apply to all other states. And they basically have succeeded in doing that. Mm-hmm. So you have a de facto ban on fishing in the high seas, a directed fishing in the high seas, for salmon. Now, this may actually be not perfectly efficient, but second best efficient, in the sense that the management, what you're doing is you're limiting the common property problem to, I think it's five states. Whereas if there was open fishing in the high seas, and I think this has been pretty effective. Mm-hmm. So I think there are cases like this that are exceptions that would be effective. On the paper by Costello and White, in my own paper, I spent a lot of time trying to understand the difference, and I think I've got it now. The big difference is just in the economics, and I have distance, which they do not have. And in my model, remember, you want to maximize distance, and then having done that, you want to choose the optimal, the best level of effort. They're just choosing effort, they're not choosing distance, But in their model, costs are falling in the size of the stock. And in my model, they're not. Well, when you're looking at tuna, because you can have these things called fish aggregating devices, you basically throw, you know, let's throw this table in the ocean, and the tuna, they're going to actually aggregate under it because other fish are going to school under it. Yeah, so it's actually a very, you know, the reason you can drive a species to extinction is because they aggregate. Think about the passenger pigeon. It was a very, the most abundant bird species you could imagine in North America, but unfortunately they would flock together. And so you could always see a flock, and that's how they were driven to extinction. And tuna do that too. So I think that their assumption, I'm not sure how powerful it is. I think it needs to be examined. I'm not saying that mine is better. I don't have that. And they don't have, those two things explain the difference.
Okay, and just to follow up on this, like if you had like a cost of enforcement, you know, that would actually scale with distance, that potentially that result would turn around.
Yeah, you know? So that's a very good point. It probably connects to the question that was made before. You know, ask the author, like, where's the weakest part of your paper? Okay, so I don't have, and by the way, none of the referees ever asked this question. I always find it interesting what people look at. I don't have monitoring, or rather I have used perfect monitoring, yeah, essentially. And I don't have enforcement costs. And I think that these things should be endogenized, yeah. It doesn't mean that what I've got would be thrown out, but you do, when you take a model, you want to play around with it to see if it's robust, right? If it's going to stand up to modifications, and that would be one to look at. You do get in the Pacific, could tell you that with the salmon, you also had a UN General Assembly resolution that was banning those long long line
the nets.
You know, they're these walls of death, those nets that just float, and they could be
the
several kilometers
floor.
Long, and they float in the ocean, and they're catching everything, mm-hmm. everything. Walls of death, the environmental groups call them, and those were banned. And you'll get U.S. Coast Guard and Canadians and others, you know, in finding, and then the U.S. will send the Coast Guard out to intercept in high seas. They do this, and that enforcement has worked. That enforcement has worked.
Let's take some more questions. I think there's one here and another one. So, gentleman with the white shirt first.
Hello. So just a question. When I think about myself as a consumer in the UK, and when I go to the supermarket, and I see there's a premium to pay for something that's MSC certified, the Marine Stewardship Council, do you think that process of consumers paying a premium to impose that duty on the supplier to be responsible is an efficient solution to the problem of overfishing?
Okay, I'm not the world's expert on this. Okay. My inclination is to think absolutely not.
Agreed.
Now, is it helpful? Possibly. I mean, for fisheries conservation. Would I do it myself? Probably. Now, what is happening, though, that is interesting. People reasonably care not only what the product is, but how it was obtained. I think people care about child labor, another example, right? So I think people care about that. What I would like to see is a common standard. And there is much better tracking now, so you can actually determine, with all this new technology, you actually determine when and where fish were caught and how they were transported around and so on. They call it a chain of something, a chain of, not command, but a chain of something, not custody, something, chain of something. And I think that is part of the tightening up our ability to regulate more carefully. Yes, but what you actually want to do is not just reward the ones that are fishing properly, because that's not addressing the ones that are not fishing properly. So you've got, it keeps coming back again and again to wanting to tighten up on that. You know, in a phrase, it's called IUU fishing, which is illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing. That's the bigger problem.
Thank you. I think we had another question in the back. Yeah.
Thank you for the insightful presentation. My question is about the tragedy of horizons that put forward by Mark Carney. It's about the climate change, where the cause of this climate change, the nation that caused the climate change, is not get the effect directly. So talk about how climate change affect the oceans. What do you think about the future ocean governance framework that can cope with this kind of dynamics, where maybe some kind of poor or developing countries get more effect than the others? Is there any like a governance framework that we can expect it to deal with this kind of issue? Thank you.
It's a great question, and it's the last two slides I think I have. Well, what's happening now is that climate change is changing everything. And we're just at the, gosh, I was going to use the tip of the iceberg expression, but that's unfortunate. We're just like looking over the edge at what's coming. And the oceans are going to be changed profoundly by this. Now, first of all, you've got change in ocean temperatures. That's moving the fish, okay? Now the fish that don't move can be harmed, like in coral reef areas, for example. They move over very long periods of time, but not over the times and period we're talking about for climate change right now. So the fish are moving. And remember, these EEZs were established in relation to the fish. So that's one issue. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned before, where are you going to define the EEZ? Is it where it is today or where it was when it was agreed in the 1970s? Or is it going to be where it moves because the seas are rising and then temperatures are changing and the fish are moving? So that's going to be a point of dispute and conflict. And those small island states I mentioned before, which have had some power in the past, it could be that they're going to be losing some power as these things change. I mean, some of them may even disappear. So it depends on the extent of sea level rise and so on. There's so many other things that are happening. The chemistry of the oceans is changing. So you're getting acidification. You're also getting a drop in oxygen. So that's going to have effect on marine life throughout the oceans. And on top of this, you might want to use the ocean as a way to address climate change. So one is you throw in lead particles to stimulate blooms, phytoplankton blooms, that can draw CO2 out of the air. Another one is you add alkaline material to the oceans. That will reduce the acidification, but it also will take CO2 out of the atmosphere. It's actually similar to sorting out the acid rain problem, which I started studying when I was here at the LSE 500 years ago, whatever that was. Sweden, for example, used to drop lime into its lakes to make the waters less acidic, more healthy for fish and other life. So we're looking at a world where we may be modifying the oceans deliberately. You can take sea spray and throw it up into the air. And that sea spray, as it evaporates, reveals the salt particles that can reflect light away from the Earth. They're looking to do this to protect the Great Barrier Reef from climate change. And then you can do it at a larger scale to actually affect regional, if not global, temperatures. This is just the geoengineering that relates to some of the geoengineering that relates to the ocean. One other thing to mention is we're also engineering on a smaller scale. So there are people now who are looking to transplant certain species to make corals more resilient to changes. And also there are proposals for genetic modifications, even of wild species, to basically assist their evolution in a world in which we're changing the climate. I would describe the history of human development as being one of improving, it's in quotation marks, nature. And I think we've only begun. Now, how do you govern all this? The arrangements we have now, basically, the default is a state can do what it likes. Now, if a state tries to do what it likes, other states may not approve, and there could be a number of interventions to change that. Rhetorical complaints, obviously, threats, trade measures, possibly military, I think probably more unlikely, but there's a range of things that could happen. Again, it's that what we're seeing is a world with more conflict. Really interesting. So the climate negotiations started, you know, in 1990. Well, at that time, you're like, the world was looking good. I mean, things were improving. You know, Soviet Union was collapsing. South Africa was becoming majority rule. There were all these positive changes taking place in the world. And there was a belief in cooperation, if you can imagine such a world. And now it's different. And now we're moving into a world in which there's much more confrontation, much more nationalism. Technologies have changed rapidly. Our ability to govern then has not kept pace. So I think the basic, and you don't have customary law that's going to be restraining these things. That doesn't exist right now. And I don't see it arising. And in fact, just to add one last thing about this, a lot of people would love to prevent things like geoengineering, for understandable reasons. But the alternative may be worse. But there is this important question, who gets to decide? That's the essential governance question. When you have different states that are powerful, they can influence each other. And I think there will be a tendency when action is taken for it to be more multilateral than unilateral. But I think you can't take the unilateral off the table. So it's going to be part of the melee, or the international relations, I think, in the many decades to come.
Thank you so much. I think we're going to have to wrap up, but
on that like, positive note,
on very deep and provocative thoughts on geoengineering. I really like this. Thank you so much, Scott, for your talk.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.